Welcome to Virtual Economy, a podcast about the business of games for the rest of us. We're your hosts. I'm Michael Footer.
And I'm Amanda Farrow.
On each episode, we'll cover the biggest business beats and bring in expert commentary from lawyers, analysts, and industry pros. This is episode 77, Why MLB The Show 21 is on Game Pass on opening day.
But they're not the opening band.
Maybe they're the opening band. Maybe they're opening for themselves. Maybe they are both in the box and unwrapping the box from the inside.
That's really strange. Also, that's extremely meta and it's breaking my brain. I don't have enough coffee in my system to parse literally any of that.
Well, we will definitely be talking about that situation in a little bit. But first, we're going to close the loop on one of the big stories we talked about last week.
Yeah.
Which was the report out of the Gamer that Sony was planning on closing its PlayStation 3, PSP, and Vita stores. Now, before we begin, I don't understand why the Gamer took shit from people for this story.
Because they thought that they were lying, that they were fabricating, that they somehow would go to print about something
that they didn't have multiple sources on. I think this is also, and we're going to talk about tribalism in console gamers in a little bit.
We're going to get there.
With the headline story for this episode, but Indeed. Let's talk a little bit about what's going on with Sony.
So last week we had read the piece on The Gamer about Sony reportedly going to be closing the storefronts for the PlayStation 3, the PlayStation Portable, and the PlayStation Vita.
Yes. Now, what wasn't in that story was what was going to happen to the games that you already purchased the license.
Now, you and I had surmised that based on the technological constraints that if they pulled those servers down, we wouldn't be able to access those games anymore.
And I'm still curious because as we discussed, like I went and I plugged in our PlayStation TV and I plugged in my Vita and made sure it was charged and everything and downloaded a whole bunch of games. And you have to do it through the store. It's extremely cumbersome to begin with, especially because there is no web store anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
They pulled that down. Like, we'll talk about that.
They did. So the storefront, so here's the deal. So you will be able to still download and play the games that you own after the storefronts close. You and I had been under the impression that that might not have been the case.
Right.
So I'm really, really glad to see that at the very least, we're not losing access to especially your robust library. I don't have much of a digital library when it comes to anything other than, you know, Steam. it's been great. It was great to hear that Sony is at the very least going to honor the fact that a good chunk of us have purchased digital only games, especially for the Vita.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things that I'm looking up right now, so VGC, again, because these web stores are gone, finding this data is really hard. So VGC ran a story yesterday, that said that the headline was VGC data suggests 2,200 PlayStation games will disappear when stores close. That's 2,200 games that you will no longer be able to play or purchase. Now, some of those are digital Vita games. Some of those are digital PSN games that never were released at retail. For me, in the last hurrah, in the next couple months, I'm going to be purchasing a ton of PS1 classics for our PlayStation TV. Mm-hmm. I think that's actually a better PS1 mini console in some ways than the PS1
That's mini. A very hot take, and I like that. So, as a reminder, or rather as a clarification, the PlayStation 3 and PlayStation Portable storefronts will be closed on July 2nd.
Mm-hmm.
The Vita storefront will remain open until August 27th.
Yes.
So,
I'm sure if this is one of those times where I strongly suggest following Wario64 on Twitter, putting notifications on, because not only has Wario saved me personally a ton of money, but always tweets reminders like, hey, get those Game Pass games before they rotate out, or the Epic games. Now, this is going to be one where it's like, hey, just a reminder, you have X number of days to make your purchases before they're gone.
Yeah, absolutely.
And now you have to do it through the consoles, because last week when The Gamer broke this news, you could still access the old web store, which allowed you to purchase Vita and PSP and PS3 games.
Certainly. And so as a, you know, we're currently working on a story for Virtual Economy for the website, since we're doing a little more writing these days. We're currently working on a story about some of the hidden costs that are associated with keeping these legacy storefronts up. To give us a bit more of a broad perspective about what needs to go into this in order to create more accessibility for video game preservation, because, mm-hmm. that's why we require video game preservation societies and nonprofits like the one that I work for at HitSave.
Absolutely.
You know, because otherwise, what are we supposed to do? Just watch 2,200 games disappear and never be able to access them again?
And it's not just the games, of course. It's the actual storefronts. The storefronts themselves are artifacts that are worth preserving.
I agree. Absolutely.
So one of the things that I do want to point out here is that this may not simply be a cost issue. And we're exploring that right now.
We are.
Because you'll recall that when Xbox Live launched, they were selling for $10 name changes. So there was, in their database, and this is, we're going to get into the weeds a little bit, because you've worked with databases, I've worked with databases. You have a key field, right? That is
your
primary key. Yep, your primary key, which is your unique identifier for every record.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the reason why you probably could not change PlayStation Network names is because rather than using a key field with a random generated number that is invisible to the player.
So a GUID.
Yes. They very likely used your PlayStation name as the primary key. And when you do that, you absolutely cannot change that value.
Yeah, that's irresponsible database design, but so, that's for another day.
So they have since, after years and years and years of people requesting, made it so that you could change it. It didn't come without problems. It broke some stuff.
It broke a lot of things when that was first rolled out, and that was rolled out a couple years ago.
Yeah, and I think that part of what's going on is they are finally moving over to smarter tech, which is why they had to dump the old web stores. And there's stuff that's lost with that, as we've talked about.
There is.
Here's some more good news, though. You will still be able to download and play your PlayStation Plus games as long as you're still an active PlayStation Plus member. You can still redeem game and PlayStation Plus vouchers on PS3, Vita, and PSP after the store is closed. So it's not that you can't access those games and get those entitlements. They're just not letting you purchase them with real money, which is very interesting.
Huh.
They're putting up a wall between us and being able to newly purchase those games. Matt Piscatella interestingly tweeted that he's curious about what the sales numbers are going to look like for some of these games over the next couple of months.
Yeah.
Because I don't know about you, but I am planning on going to grab the PS3 out of, I don't know if it's in storage or downstairs in the basement, pull it out, connect it, update it, make sure everything's good, and figure out if there are any PS3 games that we don't own that are exclusives to that system that we want to own. I'm telling you, every PS1 game I think that I can buy, I'm going to be purchasing for our PlayStation TV.
Absolutely. So one of the things that I do really want to discuss, though, is how this could have been the nail in the coffin when it comes to trust issues around digital downloads. Now, a lot of our libraries, even though you and I both have pretty comprehensive digital libraries on Steam, mm-hmm. and for me on Switch, we still have a broad physical library because we tend to see digital games can disappear, but physical games can't.
Right. For the PlayStation 4, of course, we've since learned that that isn't the case. So when PlayStation 4 reaches end of life and they decide to make these changes, they're going to have to push through a firmware patch that decouples the licensing for even playing the discs, because the trophy system relies on the system clock.
Yeah.
They're going to have to push through a firmware patch that decouples that so people can still play their physical games. So a couple of other things. Wallet funds will obviously no longer be valid for PlayStation 3, PSP, or Vita purchases. That makes sense because the stores are coming down. Our recommendation, by the way, on PS1 games, pick up all of the Final Fantasy games that are there. There's those Final Fantasy collections that they released. Pick up Vagrant Story, a game sorely in need of a reboot and remaster. Gosh, that game is good. And the original Resident Evil trilogy, Resident Evil 1, 2, and 3, because they're not on PC.
No. They are not on PC.
So
I would imagine they would run quite garbage on PC.
Yeah. So ultimately, this isn't just a good call. It is the right call, because without this, they would have absolutely destroyed trust.
Completely.
You said,
like,
in digital purchasing.
I think that people, like, as we have watched the shift to digital, mm-hmm. and we have, as GameStop has been rightly lambasted for not keeping up with the times, so to speak, and we're watching publishers like Ubisoft and like Electronic Arts and Activision really raking in a lot of the goods for not just from recurrent revenue because of digital sales, but because of digital sales all by themselves. We're seeing that ratio move far more towards digital games. If this ended up happening, that trust wouldn't have just been eroded. It would have been completely disintegrated. Yep. There would be no reason to ever buy a digital game, especially on a Sony platform, ever again.
Yeah, I think this is also very interesting. Nintendo obviously shuttered the Wii eShop and shuttered the Virtual Console.
But there's a reason why we don't have a ton of... When it comes to games that we absolutely want to keep and hold on to, even if they're not initially available as physical games, mm-hmm. like we're thinking like games like Battle Chef Brigade, a lot of the indies that I've loved, I just buy the physical versions when they come out as collector's editions.
I bought a physical version of Hades on Switch.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's really important to keep that in mind as well, that it's not just Sony that does this. This is also a Nintendo problem.
But it is not a Microsoft problem, which just also in the same week announced that, oh, hey, we're expanding cloud gaming to include a number of Xbox 360 and OG Xbox backwards compatible titles. So I think we're I continue to be mystified by Sony on this particular conversation is in two places. One, they could have gotten in front of this as soon as the gamer story broke. Yeah. They should have changed their timetable and said, okay, we want to address this because we don't want speculation. Here's what is happening. Here's what isn't happening. Here's the good news. Here's the not so good news. The other thing is they have PlayStation Now, and we're going to talk about this in a moment, but this seems like another place where PlayStation Now could be a really good solution. Mm-hmm. And it seems
funnel
like
people into that service more specifically. They were first to market, for crying out loud. Yep. Anyway, we will get there, but that's the thing that just baffles me.
Yep. So those two things, I think there was a PR fail here, and I think there is something that they are communicating very strongly about their interest in PlayStation Now as a real value add. I just don't think they see it as something that's important. And until and unless that changes, they are not going to get my money for that subscription. If they come out with a valid Game Pass competitor, I will strongly consider it because Game Pass is the best value in gaming. I continue to maintain that. But let's talk about Game Pass.
We should talk about Game Pass because in the most absolutely banana pants news of the last week, because I can't even say that it's the year. I know you have it in here of the year.
It was a joke. Really. Not really.
No, not even a little bit. But it's like the most banana pants, you know, news of the week. Microsoft has announced that MLB The Show 2021 is coming to Xbox Game Pass. Not just coming to Xbox Game Pass a week, a month, or 6 months later. Day and date with the release.
So April 20th.
With the release, yeah.
When the game comes out. Now remember, MLB The Show is a Sony game.
It's Sony game. San Diego it's not Studio. Just an exclusive game. It is a first party game.
It is a first party game. So when it was announced that MLB The Show was coming to Xbox, that was already huge. Because there hasn't really been a huge baseball game on Xbox.
No, there hasn't.
So what's interesting to me, and this I did not know when this news started to break, Sony is not publishing the game on Xbox.
Okay, and I suppose that makes sense because how many hats do you think Jim Ryan would have to eat before that happened?
Well, and what's weird though is Microsoft is published on Nintendo, or is on Nintendo, right?
Microsoft also sees itself as an ecosystem. Exactly. Or Xbox, rather, sees itself as an ecosystem rather than a platform.
Yep, and you've got Microsoft, you've got Minecraft, that's on Sony. Yeah. That's on PlayStation. So,
absolutely.
So Microsoft, and obviously Sony, you know, Sony San Diego had to go through the process of getting test kits.
Yep.
For Xbox One and Xbox Series consoles.
That was a surreal experience.
I'm sure, but to me, it's a really cool thing to me. But, so Sony's not the publisher of the Xbox version. That's MLB Advanced Media, which is the MLB's digital arm, which handles video games and VR.
Right.
So, super interesting here that this is not exactly Microsoft paying Sony as a publisher for a Game Pass game.
Obviously not, because they'll be paying MLB Advanced Media.
But indirectly, because obviously there's a relationship there.
There is, yeah. So it's Sony's like benefit. Sony's still going to benefit from this relationship, but I feel like because there is this tribalism, and we're gonna get to the whole tribalism thing in a second, but I think that in order to try to mitigate it from the outside, they're like, oh, no, this is an MLB thing, this isn't an us thing.
So, Sony could answer this. Sony could put the game on PlayStation Now, or they could put it on PlayStation Plus. Now, let's talk about those two things. Now, we just talked about PlayStation Now. it does seem clear that Sony, at least at the top, is not interested in PlayStation now. Yes, they continue to add games, but Jim Ryan has already said he's not interested in a Game Pass-like subscription service.
No, he wants people to pay full price for their for first-party games and third-party games on that platform. Sony has already said that the PlayStation 5 is about exclusivity.
Yep, absolutely.
Right? And being exclusive means that you're excluding things and people. And, like, exclusivity is, like, platform exclusivity is one of those things where it is very quickly becoming a relic of its time.
It is. So PlayStation Plus is forever. So if you claim that game during that month, as long as you're an active member, you've got that game forever.
Right.
Game Pass games rotate out. So we don't know how long MLB The Show 21 is actually going to be on Game Pass. It could be 3 months. It could be 6 months. It could be a year. It could be indefinitely.
It could be, but we don't know what the terms of that contract looks like, obviously.
Right. So, but on Game Pass, Sony gets the money from Microsoft indirectly.
Yes.
Right? They... Sony and MLB Advanced Media create an install base on a new platform with no risk.
The biggie on this one, though, is that they're allowing players to become engaged on this platform and get them comfortable with recurrent spending since there was no additional entry fee. It's the recurrent. Remember, every time you and I talk about recurrent spend, that's the big thing for a lot of publishers and a lot of, like, larger developers. Listen, the recurrent spend is where the most, it's where the most bang for the buck is.
Mm-hmm. And it's huge in sports games, right? It's we talk huge. About FIFA, we talk about NHL, we talk about Madden, we talk about NBA. Absolutely. And here we are talking about it in the show because that is something that's been in the show for a while.
Exactly.
So really, really interesting. This also allows them to then remove the game
after
a couple of months when, and players are already invested. So if you have people who are in that loop through the baseball season who are invested in recurrent revenue, you remove the game. Now, remember, you get that 20% discount, I think it is.
I think it's 20%.
If something's going to come off Game Pass.
Yep.
So you're converting sales of highly qualified players. So you've already got this install base. You're removing the game. Oh, I love playing MLB. I guess I'm going to have to purchase it now. And you're purchasing at that point at a discount, even if it's 20% off the $60 or $70.
Right.
You're still giving people a discount, and you're converting, and you're still getting close to that full price.
Right. And the conversion is the important. It's the important piece of the puzzle here that we don't tend to talk about too much, especially with regards to having just baked in qualified leads.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, you don't have to go out and spend a bunch of money on, you know, I'm looking for the...
User acquisition.
We got there. I need like 5 more cups of coffee today because I had my vaccine yesterday and my brain is foggy. Yes, it is so important because investing in that initial, you know, acquisition spend is like, it is extremely spendy. This would pay for itself. Almost.
Well, they're getting paid for user acquisition.
It's beautiful.
Data. And that's the thing. Data that Sony and its consumers are going to benefit from. And this is the short-term view of the angry consumer, which we'll talk about in a second. This could ultimately help PlayStation players in a big way.
Absolutely.
So this is going to help Sony get understanding and decision-making data around subscriptions.
Mm-hmm.
And even though they're not the publisher on the Xbox version, they're going to get the necessary data from the MLB. It's probably part of the relationship.
And they
have the telemetry. I mean, they're the developer.
It's baked into their systems. They'll be able to see how those conversions work and what players are most interested in and how much time they're spending and when they bounce off. And, you know, all of that is baked right into the game, I would imagine.
So this could ultimately lead to Sony taking PlayStation Now seriously like they should have all along.
Maybe.
So, interestingly, the Xbox Wire post was written by Jamie Lees, who is MLB's Senior Vice President of Games and VR. It was not only not written by someone from PlayStation or San Diego Studio, neither of them are mentioned at all in the blog post. So the developer is not mentioned at all.
So this, once again, speaks to me as we don't want to tick off the Sony fans more than we already will because Sony has billed the PlayStation as an exclusive. Like Sony
or
is
MLB
about
could have said you're not allowed to mention, or I'm not allowed to mention Sony. Sony doesn't want to be mentioned at all in this post.
Of course they don't want to be mentioned at all in the post. They don't want their fans to come back and be like, oh, you guys agreed to this? Oh, we thought this was just like corporate nonsense. You guys are good. We'll get to that when it comes to Sony
projects. Well, and
here
we go. And here we go. So, obviously, MLB The Show fans on PlayStation are pissed. And I've seen the terms, like, the phrase slap in the face bandied about. And I can understand that reaction a little bit because this is contextual. And I don't agree with the way it's being communicated. I encourage people to feel their feelings, but to handle them like adults. Here's the thing. If you have been invested in the game year after year, if you have purchased the game year after year, and it's coming to a new platform.
So what?
Well, exactly. So what? But you
who
have
cares?
But you have this very human reaction of, why are they getting something I can't have? And
it's
someone
literally the same.
It's exactly the same. And but this context, hey, remember we saw this on the Xbox side when a month before Quantum Break came out. It was originally supposed to be a console exclusive, and they said it's coming to PC day and date. Xbox, the Xbox side of the console warriors were furious. Well, this is supposed to be a console exclusive.
But it doesn't, like, okay, so I'm never going to understand this because I've never really been a platform warrior myself. Mm-hmm. Because my background's in computer science, I've worked on all kinds of operating systems. I'm platform agnostic. I've always been platform agnostic. I don't care where the experience is. As long as it makes sense for me, for my budget, for my life,
sure,
for all of it. And what is it, you know, the thing that always bothered me, especially in the 90s, mm-hmm. right, when the console wars were really starting to heat up in the 90s, is that you had your Sega fans and you had your Nintendo fans. And, like, they rabidly hated each other.
Well, except on my street where my buddy who lived down the street, they were a Sega house and we were a Nintendo house, which worked out perfectly.
Yeah, well, I didn't know any Sega kids growing up because, like, none of them lived where I lived, and it was mostly just Nintendo. I think my cousins had a Sega. But my point with this is this level of tribalism is a relic. It's a relic of a bygone age that no longer needs to exist, especially with things like cross-progression, with cross-play across platforms.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, it's not in line with the way that many developers and some publishers want to exist within the game industry as it is. They want a bigger audience. They want to be able to reach as many people as possible. So insulating even more doesn't make sense. Opening up.
Sure.
Does.
No. From the strategy perspective, I
completely... not even just from strategy, but as a player, for me, that's more people for me to play with. That's more people for me to talk to. That's more people for me to connect with. Why don't I want that?
I think that this is not a matter of well, for some people it's stupid gatekeeping. For others, if this were MLB The Show 23, we'd be having a different conversation because consoles are scarce right now. Budgets are... Remember, these consoles just came out. We've talked about this before.
Okay, no. But what is that... Literally, what does that have to do with anything?
Because I bought a PlayStation to play MLB The Show. Okay, it's fine that it was coming to Xbox, but now if I had purchased an Xbox instead, I could... And have Game Pass, I would get to play that on day one without dropping the extra money. Again, we're coming down to...
But those people are also
spending huge recurrent money.
Exactly,
like,
and that's also a delay on... having to spend the full amount or as close to the full amount as you're going to anyway, because that's going to eventually come off Game Pass. And like you said, you're going to have to end up converting to the full game eventually.
I'm not endorsing these
I'm just
explaining. I can see where some of these things come from.
It's still nonsensical to me. Like, I'm sitting here and I understand it logically-ish, but it's still so bonkers.
I will say this. I understand the feeling around it.
Yeah, I still don't.
I decry the behavior that it leads to.
No, I know.
I'm just trying to understand the console fanboys, Amanda.
But I don't want to.
I know.
It's not that I don't understand them. It's that kind of logic doesn't hold water anymore. It just doesn't. You know, regardless of whether or not you purchase a PlayStation to play MLB The Show 2021, or you buy an Xbox to play Halo, and, like, who cares? Like, find your niche. Like, it is okay to say, hey, I am buying a PlayStation because I know that this game that I love is going to be coming to this platform.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to wall off everyone else because you don't...
Oh, no, that kind of feeling I don't understand.
That's
like, trying
the thing
to,
that I don't get.
The gatekeeping shit I don't understand.
Yeah, for it should be exclusive and it should be just on my console.
No. That I don't understand and that I can't justify. What I can understand is if someone... And this comes back to our conversation about pricing is about accessibility. Pricing is about diversity and inclusion.
Absolutely.
Where if someone's sitting there going, okay, now I'm really regretting picking the PlayStation over Xbox because I only play a few games and I wanted the best console to play MLB. And now I could have done this and gotten a whole bunch of other games with Game Pass. And...
Based on that logic, I can understand that. But based on the entitlement of...
No. I'm not... So to be clear, I don't understand, endorse, or defend the gatekeeping or entitlement. Like, that stuff is bonkers to me.
It was still really important for us to talk about. Yes. It was really important for us to talk about it. And I do appreciate the additional perspective around bringing it all back to diversity and inclusion and bringing it back to, no, it isn't just about, oh, I'm sad I picked the wrong console and I don't want anyone else to experience this game the way that I'm experiencing it. No, I made the wrong consumer decision because I could have more games and the game that I really love.
It comes back to the whole confirmation bias in an environment of scarcity. Sure. Resources and scarcity of availability for the consoles.
Okay.
That's, for me, that's the piece.
I like that. I think that's a much more robust way of looking at it. So thank you for your perspective.
Why, thank you. Thank you so much. Here's some things I don't understand.
Oh, gosh. Are we going to dig into CD Projekt now?
Yeah. So CD Projekt announced that they are making some strategy changes, and some of them make a lot of sense and others really don't to me. And while you're talking about this, I'm just going to pull up the stock price. So
yeah, we'll get there. So this is a piece that I am currently working on for the beginning of next week. So we're not going to dive in too deep because I'm going to take my piece to do that. So first things first, Cyberpunk 2077 has received another enormous patch with hundreds of improvements. Reading through the list, pretty sure that CD Projekt Red doesn't get a gold star. And the big question that remains is that it's clear that this game was launched in the state it was, not because it was deemed ready, but because of business. And that decision has ultimately hurt the company. How badly has it hurt the company?
So the stock is now under 200 zloty. And the last time it was as low as it is now was the end of March in 2019. Remember, it spiked to over 400, I believe, and before the game came out, like, I think it was closing in the high 300s.
It was, and part of that was because a lot of the previews that were coming back were very positive, and...
I have thoughts about that, but that's not for this show.
If you would like to engage with us about those thoughts, you can find us on Twitter.
Or on Discord.
Or on Discord. Sometimes we share things in Discord. So, yeah. Mike... What else is going on here? There's some talk around video.
Yeah, so there's videos that have surfaced since the patch from creators like Vinesauce, where some of the issues...
Severe issues. They're not just like little nitpicky things. Like, these are big design and development flaws.
Yeah, so Polygon wrote an interesting piece with some of this stuff. So it's not just old problems that continue, there are new problems.
Because that's what happens.
Yeah.
All the time. You fix one thing, and then five more things are broken as a result of you fixing the one thing.
Yep.
This is not a new thing. Anyone that has ever built any software ever knows that that's the case. You kill one bug, five more pop up.
Yep. And there's no word yet on when it's returning to the PlayStation Store.
That's the big problem right now. The big problem is that this entire time that this has been a game that is not accessible from the PlayStation Store, literally.
Yeah, they're going to have to go through cert again, and that's a 4 to 6 week process depending on the time of year. So they have also announced in this big thing at the end of the month, this whole strategy revamp. They posted a video on YouTube. So their strategy now has three different pillars. One of them is online. CD Projekt Red wants to expand its IPs to online and use GOG Galaxy as a way to lever some of that. We're going to talk a little bit about what online means for Cyberpunk in a minute. They also want to build out. So CD Projekt Red wants to build value through bringing its IP to other platforms like mobile and strike more partnerships. So that's television and merch.
This is the one that makes the most sense.
Yes.
They have really installed fan bases, especially for The Witcher. The Witcher mm-hmm. is like, lots of people laud The Witcher 3 especially as one of the most important games of the last generation. For good reason.
Yeah.
And obviously they have the television show on Netflix, and
season 2 just wrapped up filming.
Absolutely. But remember that The Witcher is not originally written by the good folks at CD Projekt Red.
No, they've adapted the novel. novels.
They adapted the novels. So, but the merch portion, oh yeah. If Absolutely. There's anything I learned from my research when I was talking about Animal Crossing mm-hmm. and licensing for merchandising, merch partnerships are enormous. They continue to be enormous. They continue to be, you know, the thing that really gets fans reinvigorated for another development cycle, for a new game, for, you know, whatever else is going to be happening. So, like, creating transmedia, you know, opportunities for these IPs is such a smart, it's such a smart thing mm-hmm. to do. And also, it's about 5 years behind.
Absolutely. And the last one is Transform. So Red 2.0 is their new strategy plan. And it's the core of their new organizational approach. Mm-hmm. CD Projekt Red is hoping to move to parallel development. So that's multiple AAA projects at a time beginning in 2022. So next year.
So here's the big problem with parallel development. First of all, you need to have dedicated teams if you're moving in parallel. You can't be cannibalizing one to work on the other. Mm-hmm. You have to have your dedicated teams. Additionally, CD Projekt Red has already demonstrated they cannot work on single, let alone parallel.
Yeah, absolutely. So what came out of this was that Cyberpunk multiplayer is effectively dead, at least as a standalone game. Remember, they had ambitions. It seems very clear they've never said this publicly, I don't think, but their ambitions were very GTA Online. So launching Cyberpunk as the GTA 5 piece of that,
yeah.
and then having a fully robust, separate, thriving and constantly evolving online component for it. I don't know how you do that with the mess that is Cyberpunk. I can't imagine what that would be. Yeah.
You can't. It's like, so again, I haven't been a developer in years. I haven't developed software in many years mm-hmm. at this point. But if your underlying code structure is a mess, once you start adding things to a foundational mess, anything on top of that is just going to create more mess.
It is. So here's the quote. Previously, we hinted that our next AAA would be a multiplayer Cyberpunk game. We have decided to reconsider this plan. Given our new, more systematic and agile approach, instead of primarily focusing on one big online experience or game, we're focused on bringing online into all of our franchises one day. We're building an online technology that can be seamlessly integrated into development of our future games. So this sounds like...
This is R&D.
This is R&D and it's bullet point multiplayer again. It's like, oh, we want all of our games to have an online component. Okay.
That
sounds like the Xbox 360 era.
No, you're looking for recurrent spend.
Yeah.
That's what you're looking for. And while I understand that, and anyone that looks at the game industry on a regular basis like we do can understand the attractiveness of recurrent spend and tacking multiplayer into your game is not a formula for success.
Well, you don't want to play like Witcher Battle Royale?
Not even a little bit. if anything, you know what? If anything, Jedi Fallen Order showed us that there is still, and God of War, and Spider-Man, and Miles Morales, we've seen people are still hungry for single player
experiences.
Or
Witcher 3! Like Witcher 3 alone tells us that people want these big, vast experiences.
They love it. And there's a difference between wanting to play co-op with your friends, which is cool. And there should be online and local co-op for a lot of different games, because you and I love co-op games.
Yep.
We love playing them. So yes to co-op. But building out battle arenas and stuff like that, that's not helpful. That's not useful.
To me, it seems like that part of the Cyberpunk's problems might have been building a foundation here that could have been easily applied, like that they hoped would easily translate to a new multiplayer game. And ultimately, they lost sight of the ball.
Well,
right?
It's because their ambitions outstripped their capabilities.
Absolutely.
And you know what? That's okay. It is okay to say, listen, we shot for the stars on this one. We were not able to make it.
Mm-hmm.
And we did our best. And we're going to keep iterating. And we're going to keep going. But we learned a ton from this experience. And we're going to be able to take what we learned and build out something new, something different, something interesting, taking our learnings about Cyberpunk and what not to do when it comes to scope creep and overpromising and under-delivering. And take it into the next project.
Mm-hmm.
That's reasonable. But there are other problems here.
There are. So one of the other things they talked about was shortening their promotion window.
Yep.
So not announcing games years and years and years in advance and then painting themselves into a corner.
Yep.
So more on Red 2.0. They're going to, quote, further develop a sustainable and caring work environment. Hold on, because we'll talk about it in a second. Redefining and empowering the chief technology officer role, because given the tech problems with Cyberpunk.
Certainly. CTO and tech needs to be at the forefront of their learning right now.
Introducing agile working. I don't know what the hell they do now if they're not using agile.
Agile is what they teach in school. Are they working on Waterfall?
Well, that would be way out of date.
That's not just 5 years out of date, that's 15 years out of date.
Here's another tell. Centralizing Red Engine to serve both franchises, which this sounds like the Frostbite problem, right? Where they tried to take the engine that was powering The Witcher and tried to apply it to Cyberpunk because they had it in-house, and they probably had an engine that was not suitable for it.
It's not suitable because Cyberpunk was a completely different monster than The Witcher.
Mm-hmm.
The Witcher didn't have the same array of complex systems. Yeah, there was crafting and everything like that and relationships to manage, but like Cyberpunk was extremely ambitious even in their system design.
Yep. Create a team of cross-project experts and cross-functional teams. So software engineers, designers,
and
graphics developers working on both. I think that makes a lot of sense.
It does, and hopefully, and based on this, where it's like, okay, they're cross-project experts and cross-functional teams. I like that. But also, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to be able to go from one to two, like, as often as they want to. They're going to have to bake in internal systems to ensure that they're taken care of.
And that's part of what we've heard is a bit of a big problem at CD Projekt.
Indeed.
Project management. So, obviously, we talked about changing their approach to external communications. I hope they change their approach to internal communications, too, because a lot of what's been going on is the friction where you've had leaders who have been throwing the studio and the team under the bus in earnings calls and then having to apologize for it. And because it hits the press, of course.
And it's also a problem with the left hand not talking to the right hand.
Oh, totally.
Absolutely. And how many times have we seen that, even at larger companies, even like Sony, for crying out loud, where the left hand doesn't know what the right hand's doing. Google, like a lot of companies suffer from this. But when it comes to internal communications, it needs to be crystal clear. And you need to be on your people's side.
Yeah. They're going to be scaling up their talent pool. We know there was some brain drain after The Witcher 3 because of all the crunch. So they also talked about roadmaps.
And other cultural issues.
Oh, yeah, and other cultural issues. So quickly, they had very simple roadmaps for Cyberpunk and The Witcher. For Cyberpunk, patches and updates, free DLC similar to this free DLC that came out with The Witcher 3, and then doing the next-gen update for Cyberpunk because, gosh, oof. And then for The Witcher, there is The Witcher Monster Slayer, which is a mobile AR game that's coming.
Oh, that's cool.
Yep. The next gen update for The Witcher 3 will be in the second half of calendar 2021. And of course, they're going to continue working on Gwent. Now, we mentioned that they want to create a sustainable and caring work environment.
Okay.
What they said about that was that they want it to be comfortable. So they want to prioritize inclusiveness and diversity and the well-being of their employees. They want it to be open, so that there's bilateral internal communication and a barrierless environment.
What does that even mean?
Oh, open door policy.
No, open door policies don't work.
No, because they're often bullshit. And then empowering, taking on ambitious projects and fostering personal development. And here's all I'm going to say about this. Bullshit. Until you show me otherwise, bullshit.
Because
you were
lied.
The studio, you came out and said we're not going to crunch on Cyberpunk, and you outright lied.
You outright lied. And even if it came from a place of the best of intentions, it doesn't change the fact that CD Projekt Red crunched their people to the point where they couldn't function anymore.
Yep. Which introduced more bugs, et cetera, et cetera. And we've talked about crunch multiple times on the show. So that's kind of the rundown here. Investors obviously have looked at this and said, okay, so the AAA game that you told us was going to bring in a ton of recurrent revenue isn't coming.
Cool.
Okay, so they're selling off. People are getting out.
Yeah, people are divesting.
Yes.
Which is understandable.
It's
if we were investors,
no,
I would have been out. I would have been out last summer.
Yeah. So that is everything on CD Projekt Red, except it's not, because it's time for
M&A Minute.
M&A Minute. Starting off with CD Projekt.
CD Projekt has acquired Digital Scapes, which is being rebranded as CD Projekt Vancouver. Now, according to the press release, Digital Scapes worked on Cyberpunk 2077 for 3 years. CD Projekt CTO and head of production, Pavel Zavadny.
Probably.
Cool. I almost got it.
You almost got it.
I almost
got
it.
So the W's are V's.
The W's are V's. Okay, I'm learning. We're getting this together. Remember, I speak French. And that's like it. said, quote, Digital Scapes has have put out put in, rather, a great deal of work during the making of Cyberpunk 2077, assisting with the development of the game and optimizing its features. In addition to contributing to our projects, the new team will help us perfect our technologies and will broaden our competencies in this respect. So the studio employs about a dozen people, covering, quote, multiplayer development, programming, and animation for all major hardware platforms. No terms were disclosed. CD Projekt says it's on the lookout for more M&A opportunities going forward.
Yeah, very interesting.
I'll dive a little deeper into what that means for CD Projekt in my piece.
Absolutely. Nexon has made sizable investments in a number of game publishers. The South Korean / Japanese company has dropped $874 million in Hasbro, which owns Wizards of the Coast, Sega Sammy, Bandai Namco, and Konami. The company's board has authorized up to $1.5 billion in entertainment company investment, and they say there is no intent on acquisition or activism. These are described as, quote, long-term friendly investments. In other words, it sounds like Nexon is following the Tencent playbook.
That's very interesting.
Very interesting.
And I would really like to see more of that. Mm-hmm. Like, friendly investment. We believe in your IP. We believe in your business. Mm-hmm. We want to support it. We're not looking to acquire you. We just want a little piece of the good stuff that you're doing.
I'm really interested to see what drove the Konami decision, though.
Patchy slots.
All right.
Nordisk Games has made an investment in Until Dawn developer Supermassive Games. That's so cool. I love Supermassive. The deal gives Nordisk 30.7% ownership of the company. Now, as a reminder, Nordisk is no stranger to the game industry because they have multiple investments in Avalanche Studios, Flashbulb Games, Multiverse, Nitro Games, Star Stable Entertainment, which is very cool because Star Stable is actually enormous, Raw Fury, Redomoto, and Mercury Steam. The company has says it has invested more than 135 million euro in a portfolio of Nordic game studios. This is another thing that you and I have been keeping our eye on, is what is going on in all of those countries.
With investment?
Yeah, with investment. It's something we continue to watch.
It is fascinating. Moving on. Graffiti Games, located in Vancouver, has raised $1.5 million from private investors to support its indie publishing effort. The company was founded in 2017 and has published 10 games, including Juggernauts, Blue Fire, and Turnip Boy Commits Tax Evasion, which I think just came out. Blue Fire's on the way out. The company's now valued at $4.5 million, so this was great for them.
This is now two companies that are being highlighted from Vancouver, which is very, it's fascinating because Vancouver went through an enormous dip when it came to game development because real estate is still unaffordable. And we're not just talking about residential real estate, we're talking about commercial real estate in almost all of Vancouver, including the greater Vancouver area.
Yes.
So because that bubble is not going to pop necessarily, but it is certainly contracted, I really hope that this is going to reinvigorate the development scene in Vancouver. It's just like, that's always going to be my city. That's always going to be my home. So, you know, I'm pulling for Van.
Nice.
Tencent has acquired a 5% stake in Black Myth Wukong developer Game Science. Game Science is a Chinese indie that was founded in 2014.
505 Games has purchased the Ghost Runner IP from publisher All In Games. The deal is worth 5 million euros. All In will still receive a portion of profits from game sales. They're co-publishing the game.
Nice.
All In and 505 were actually both vying for the IP rights from developer One More Level back when the game was earlier pre-release.
For sure.
It recovered its 2.5 million euro production costs on its first day, which was October 27th, 2020.
That's very cool. It's still on my wish list. I'm
same.
I still really want to play Ghost Runner because it looks really cool. Speaking of really cool things, I love covering Manticore. So Manticore has closed its $100 million Series C funding led by XN, with SoftBank Vision 2 and LVP joining in, and Benchmark, Bitcraft's new opportunity fund, Correlation Ventures, and Epic Games upping their existing investments. Core will be available in early access exclusively on the Epic Games Store starting on April 15th. There are currently 20,000 free games on the Metaverse platform from its alpha phase.
Very cool.
I really enjoy covering Manticore because what they're doing is very, very, like, I feel like it's just pulling down barriers to entry for development.
Mm-hmm.
And for, especially for folks that are like, I really want to make video games, but I have no idea where to start.
Mm-hmm.
Super cool.
And that was M&A Minute. And now it's time for Quick Hits.
Can we talk about Monster Hunter?
For a moment, because this is a quick hit, and then we can go play Monster Hunter.
Woohoo! I love playing Monster Hunter. All right, Monster Hunter Rise has shipped 4 million units worldwide. The series has now shipped 66 million copies over its 16-plus year life.
And remember, as we've moved into digital, shipped and sold numbers have narrowed because shipped includes digital.
That's right. Instead of it being like this whole sold through versus sold in, which we have covered many times.
Yep. All right, golf is back, baby! In addition to 2K's PGA game, EA is hitting the links again. And with Mario dusting off his clubs, it looks like the sport is getting its digital due once more. More info, including the release window on EA's PGA game, is coming soon.
I love golf games, and I'm very excited for Mario Golf.
Oh, that golf scramble thing is going to be rad.
It's going to be
We have two copies pre-ordered.
We're streaming it. It's happening. This is kind of sad, though. Nielsen has shut down analyst group Superdata, and they acquired the company in 2018. I don't know. I used to go and poke around at Superdata's, you know, especially their monthly top games. That was the most valuable.
Yeah, some of their reflective data was always pretty good. I don't think they're
forward-looking.
Their forward-looking data, I didn't have as much faith in, but still, regardless,
It's sad.
With data is so hard to come by in this industry. So when the loss of anybody who is working in data
working on analysis of that data, not just like aggregating it to sell, but actually analyzing it and providing context is so important.
Absolutely. Certain Affinity has hired former 343 Industries studio director Dan Ayoub as vice president of its Canadian operations.
Ooh.
Certain Affinity is actually a longtime 343 partner, was founded by former senior Bungie staffer Max Hoberman, who worked on Halo 1 through 3, served as multiplayer online and UI design lead for Halo 2 and Halo 3, and Certain Affinity did the multiplayer portion of the Master Chief Collection and is currently working with 343 on Halo Infinite.
Certain Affinity, just as a reminder, is one of the few work-for-hire studios that is firmly against staffing up unless it is absolutely necessary. They do not staff up for specific contracts. They only staff up if that person can be available for the long-term foreseeable future. Absolutely. Certain Affinity, to me, is probably one of the most interesting work-for-hire studios out there because of their commitment to immaculate project management and resource management. All right, so let's...
I'm going to sit in the corner and cry while you read this
one. This is so sad. All right, Analog has announced a 5-month delay for its pocket portable console. I know, this is Mike's equivalent of not getting Bloodlines 2 this year. The device was due out next month, but as something that is not particularly surprising, the delay is due to electrical component shortages that are happening worldwide.
Yes.
I'm sorry, dear.
Me too.
Eventually, we will get the pocket.
Yes. And then we will hook it up because I got the dock too. We can hook it up to HDMI. Here, this is a cool one that I'm glad we're closing on. Bloober Team has opted to remain independent after considering an acquisition. The studio was exploring acquisition for a time, but VGC has translated a story from Bankier, which says that leadership opted out, quote, due to the high risk of losing its overriding strategic objectives, and that it would, quote, be incompatible with the culture of the organization and limit potential growth of the company's value. The company had discussions with 6 potential suitors, 3 in the U.S., 2 in Poland, and 1 in the U.K., but no names for those potential suitors were revealed.
I'm really happy for them. I'm really happy that they prioritized internal culture and strategy before they looked at the almighty dollar signs.
Yep, and we worked with Bloober Team.
We did.
Which we can now say. So we both really enjoyed Medium and have enjoyed their work in the past. So we're kind of excited, you know, kudos to leadership for making the right decision for their corporate culture.
It's really important. And more independent companies do need to do more of that, is make sure that you're prioritizing your people over just profit.
Absolutely. And those were quick hits.
And now it's a break. Virtual Economy is an F-Squared initiative, and along with pro bono business consulting for up-and-coming developers, it's a way we are working to give back to the community that has already given us so much. To find out more about F-Squared and the services we can provide, including pitch prep, media training, mock reviews, and business strategy guidance, visit our website at fsquared.biz.
And we're back. So we have 2 stories to round out the bottom half of the show. In fact, you're going to feel like this show might be a little top heavy because we don't have too much left to discuss.
That's
okay. It's just
going
to fall over. It's like a Barbie doll. I just mean in that you can't stand a Barbie doll if they fall over. It's what they do.
I feel so attacked right now. I want to talk about Activision and attack Activision instead.
Okay, let's do it.
God, I love attacking Activision. No, I don't actually. I don't like attacking anyone. Stop making stupid decisions.
Yeah, so, yeah.
Like, just stop. Stop
this
doing
This is terrible.
It. It's awful. You and I really need to be doing this on video.
I know.
Okay, so Activision has made some high-level staffing changes. Mike?
Yep. So this
what
is
what we got.
This one makes
this
sense.
This one's fine.
They hired or promoted Armin Zerza to chief financial officer. He's stepping up from the role as chief commercial officer of Activision Blizzard and chief operating officer of Blizzard. Now, remember, we talked about that firewall between Activision Blizzard and Blizzard, like, being fully eroded, especially when Mike Morhaime left.
Here we go.
And this is just this.
Here
is
we go.
So he is taking over for Dennis Durkin, who is retiring or has retired, and he was at Activision for a long, long time.
Yep.
But here's the one that really kind of caught our eye. The company has also hired Brian Bulatau as its chief administrative officer, and he was previously the chief operating officer of the CIA under Mike Pompeo in the Trump administration. He moved over and became the undersecretary of state when Pompeo took over the State Department as secretary of state. Bulatau is described by a Business Insider story as a bully, and was notoriously, quote, Pompeo's attack dog. And that comes from the Business Insider report from June of last year. And this is the second icky Republican that the company has hired, with the former being Francis F. Townsend, who is currently the company's chief compliance officer. Townsend was a torture apologist defending the CIA's use of torture under the W. Bush administration.
Okay, can we talk about what this means for what Activision actually
can
values?
Can you imagine working for a company that hired this guy as its chief administrative officer?
Can you even remotely imagine being anyone but a straight white male at Activision with this person in the C-suite?
No. I think that Activision is no longer hiding its corporate values. I mean,
they already weren't hiding it to begin with. You can go to any of their calls with investors, and you get a good idea of what it is that they actually value.
But hiring these people, it's not like there weren't other people who could have done this job. And quite frankly, hiring a torture apologist and then hiring somebody who worked that closely with Mike Pompeo and was his enforcer, like,
is known as an attack dog.
Yeah.
Like, that's not okay, and that is not reflective of many of the people that work in the game industry, where we're all a bunch of nerds and we're all a bunch of creatives and misfits and everything like that, and so many of us are activists in our spare time.
Also, would you want to work at a company? I mean, so let me lay the foundation here. When you work for a company, especially a large company, you should not expect that any communications that you do on company hardware or via company communication services are
private.
And at the same time, can you imagine, like, the privacy concerns around working for somebody who is the chief operating officer of the CIA and is known to be a giant dipshit like this guy? I'm sorry.
you're just like throwing the gloves off. No sock punches.
No,
today.
when it comes to people who were gleefully working for the Trump administration, screw them. Because if Activision hired this person, it says everything you need to know about diversity and inclusion and kindness in your environment. No, screw this. Screw this guy. And I'm sorry, but screw Activision for hiring someone.
And the
like this.
Worst part of this is that just before Mike left, I wrote
Mike Morhaime.
Yeah, Mike Morhaime. I think it was either just before or just after I did this big story about diversity and inclusion specifically at Blizzard and why Blizzard was taking it so seriously.
Yep.
And this is it. This is the thing. And I'm just, as a Canadian living in America, obviously having conversations around American politics are always going to be fraught with my own interpretation of them as someone who grew up in a completely different culture.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to weigh in on any of that because I'm about as left can get. I mean, I grew up in British Columbia. What do you want from my life?
Hmm.
So it's, but for me, I would never, ever, ever want to work for a company like that. That just, they're saying the soft part loud.
Yes.
And I mean, on the one hand, good for them because yeah, you're going to get what you paid for.
Yeah.
because, you know, and now you're showing everyone. So, like, okay, at least you're being honest, I guess. And on the other hand, why? Why would you do this to your developers? Why would you do this to the people that love, you know, your one game?
Crash Bandicoot's gonna get renditioned. That's all I'm gonna say.
Shit. Let's move away from this because I'm gonna get way saltier than I should.
All right, let's talk about events. Wrapping up with this last story here.
Let's talk about events. So, Mike, what's going on with E3?
VGC broke a story earlier this week that E3 is most definitely, most assuredly, and yes, for really real, going to be an online event. Now, you might recall that on the December 6th episode of Virtual Economy, we said to you, E3 is going to be a digital event. We were right. And then there was VGC reported
more. Is this where we do the I told you so dance?
Yeah, but people can't see it, so.
We really need to fix this.
I know.
We need to be on the streams.
Yeah, so this is the second time that Andy Robinson over at VGC has broken some news about E3. He managed to get his hands on the E3 online pitch deck, which despite the ESA's NDAs, I just have in the, I kid you not, in the show notes right now it says, I don't mind peeing in the ESA's Wheaties. So the pitch deck says that there's going to be a digital rebrand to, quote, the electronic entertainment experience.
Okay. All right. Apparently, quote, plans sent to publishers suggest the E3 app will include virtual booths containing content announced during the show, as well as merchandise stores and demos. And that would be in addition to the free experience.
Yeah, so this
I'm sorry, is this MTX in my event?
Yeah,
I don't know if I like that.
So I don't know if I put that sub bullet point in the right place, because I don't know. My brain, your brain. I got my Fauci ouchie this week, too.
You know. Don't blame my brain for this. These are your notes.
I would say my brain is like your brain. My brain when I was writing this is like your brain because I had my Fauci ouchie earlier this week.
Oh, okay.
So the lobbying group had expressed interest in charging a reported $35 to put some of its content behind a paywall. And it seemed like when VGC wrote its report and let the ESA know that this report was coming, and that's important, it seemed like they were being pressured to drop that fee. Quote, multiple publishing sources told VGC they expected to provide some content for the digital E3 event as a show of support for the ESA, but that they would ultimately reserve their main reveals for separate independent digital events like those held last year.
Prepare your bodies for Jeff Grubb's game mess.
Yes, exactly. So keep in mind, so VGC writing this story goes to the ESA, gets a comment from the ESA. The ESA is well aware this story is coming. All right?
Yep, definitely.
So there's also talk in this story that the ESA partnering with NVIDIA to deliver demos via GeForce Now, even though Steam Next Fest is, like, right there.
It's, like, right there. Right
And has a there. Much larger install base. We know that Steam continues to set concurrent user records. Like, and why would you do this?
They have been doing online festivals now for the last year. And prior to that, they did Ludonarikon, which is also run through Steam and has been run through Steam since 2019.
And the engagement numbers on Steam Game Fest are just going up and up and up and up.
Because you're going to use a platform. We're playing demos. We're talking to developers. You know, they're doing these panels and like it's very successful because there's a lot of eyeballs.
So I guess the ESA is saying, so we're going to partner with NVIDIA, who I guess they are getting to sponsor that. See, if I had to guess, NVIDIA is going to give them money so that they use GeForce to increase the install base. But at the same time, you're telling developers and publishers, oh, hey, you have to use this new platform that you might not have not used. And you're telling users, hey, you have to sign up for this new account and install this thing, which we all know that users absolutely love having one more icon on their desktop.
They get really salty
they
about
that.
They get
real salty about that.
I have
that.
So many icons.
So not partnering with Valve for Steam Next Fest is absolutely stupid.
Very, very silly.
And here's the thing that just grinds my gears.
Tell me about what grinds your gears, Mike.
After publication of VGC's story, the group tweeted out, and this is how it happened. So the VGC story comes out, and there are your usual people who retweet these stories. So Wario's one, Nibellion's another one, mm-hmm. 9Volt's another one, right? These are people who you can typically count on to share out like big pieces of news.
Sure.
Nibellion quote tweets or tweets and links the VGC story.
Right.
The ESA quote tweets Nibellion, not VGC, not Andy Robinson, and says this. I didn't put the text of that in here. So says essentially this.
Michael.
Yes. It's great. Leave it. Leave it in the show. Don't edit this out. This
I'm not amazing. Editing it. It's beautiful.
They tweeted out an oblique confirmation that the event is going to be digital. Remember, the ESA has still not actually come out and said yes.
No, they, E3 what is they going did, to be digital. What they did is they're like, we'll have more news on this soon. Essentially being like, winky face, this is just a teaser for later.
But they never actually said, yes, E3 is going to be digital until this quote tweet of Nebelian sharing out the VGC story. Ugh. So, and then they said, oh, it's going to be entirely free. So they knew VGC was writing this story. They had the opportunity to comment and did comment on the story and then came out 20 minutes after the VGC story broke and said, actually, it's free. So there, ha ha ha, gotcha.
Wow. That's some petty bullshit.
Well, we know the ESA comms team
does petty bullshit.
Yes. Oh, by the way, they still have never apologized for leaking the data for all the people who attended E3 2019. An actual, I'm sorry this happened, would go a long way.
It really would.
Because their priority was regaining the trust of media partners.
No, their primary goal was ensuring that they buried that story so that they would think that everyone forgot.
Yep. Nobody's forgotten, pal.
Too bad that the media, when it comes to these kinds of things, like having their information leaked to the worst parts of the internet, and then being reinforced by more worst parts of the internet. Yeah, we're not going to forget that. We're not going to forget that.
Yep. So I said this on Twitter. I'm going to reiterate it here. The ESA has no competency in putting on a digital event.
They barely have any competency in putting on an in-person event, especially if we look at what happened in 2019.
Well, yeah. And as testament to that, EA pulling out, Activision pulling out, Microsoft pulling out. Like, you know, all of these people saying, screw it, we're doing our own thing, and we're going to do it in your backyard while your event is going on. We don't need you.
We're following Devolver Digital's example.
No, they're not, because none of them give me barbecue.
That's true.
Oh my gosh.
The beer.
Shout out to Devolver Digital for having the best E3 experience.
Listen, we will always love you, especially for E3.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's not the only show news we have. In fact, this week I wrote about PAX Online. So PAX East is canceled entirely. ReedPop is trying to salvage something with a second PAX Online event in July.
Yes.
So I have been working on this story for a number of months. In fact, since PAX Online, right after PAX Online wrapped up, and I had a number of exhibitors come to me and pretty much said, did you hear about this mess?
Also, you need to write about this.
And I did a lot of research. I spoke to a number of exhibitors who expressed a variety of concerns. I have the pitch deck, and at the same time, I was able to pull together the PAX East fee schedule, the PAX South 2020 fee schedule, and for information purposes, some data about what it costs to exhibit at E3, and the full E3 2018 exhibitor manual. Now, ultimately, what my story is an examination of what happened at PAX Online 2020, but ultimately through the lens of what needs to happen in order for PAX Online 2021 to be successful.
That's right.
And so it's a lengthy piece. It's mm-hmm. like 2,700 words.
It's meaty.
It's got lots of data because I think it's really hard to find data on what it means to exhibit at an event.
Indeed.
We've linked to all of those documents
yep.
in there. So if you were at all interested in what it costs and the options for exhibiting at a PAX East or a PAX South or PAX Online in 2020, or what it takes to actually pull off a booth at E3 and how much that costs. Those are all in the story, but ultimately it comes down to three things. For PAX Online 2021 to succeed, it needs to improve its pricing.
Yep.
It needs to improve its value offering to exhibitors. And it needs to improve its communication, because one of the things we heard from a lot of exhibitors is that they could not handle communicating with people for panels. And I had a personal experience with that, which I talk about just a little bit in the story because I didn't want to make it the focus. They dropped the ball on letting people know where their digital booths, where the links to their digital booths, lots of things where people had expressed interest and they didn't hear back for months.
Yeah.
So it was a mess. It really was a mess. And I don't think that it needs to be a mess this year. And I'm hopeful. I know that there's not going to be information for a couple of weeks, and I'm hoping that we get a chance to take a look at the PAX Online 2021 deck and actually make those comparisons. And I'm very eager to write that story as well, comparing PAX Online 2020, PAX Online 2021, what's improved, where we still have concerns. The story also has at the bottom of it questions you should ask yourself and ask the event planner before you commit to spending, because your marketing resources are precious.
They cost, especially if you're an independent developer.
Absolutely. So I want to talk to you, and we've talked about this a couple of times to wrap this up, about the digital event experience. And I want you to, I think you've talked about it on the show before, but I want to circle back to it. The Boston Fig experience. Can you talk a little bit about what it was like to attend Digital Boston Fig?
Okay, so Digital Boston Fig used a very, very interesting platform that apparently I cannot remember what they used, but it allowed you to build your little avatar, and you could give your avatar, you know, like its own look. You could have like cool hair. You know, it's very important to me to have cool hair with my avatars. And you could take your little, avatar, and you can either opt in for your microphone and your camera, so that when you wander around the digital space, it's very similar to wandering around a physical space. You will be face to face with people if they also have their camera and microphone on, so that you can have one-on-one and potentially even group conversations. So when I first logged into Boston Fig, I actually ended up wandering around to a lot of booths. I checked out a number of different demo reels. I looked at trailers of what was going on with the indie games. And I would speak with the folks that were actually running the digital booth. You could have that conversation. Like if I was going up to go and shake their hand in real life and give them my card, you know, hi, I'm Amanda. I work with Hit Save. I was there for Hit Save. And I was scouting out indies to chat with for the preservation project. But it was a very similar experience to what I would have expected from a physical event, just without physically being there. The friction wasn't there in comparison to even just attending panels at something like the GamesBeat Summit. Like that was relatively frictionless as well, but it was still, you're sitting in Slack. It's just like every other online conference. Boston Fig made it interactive. They made it so that you weren't just sitting in one place and not interacting with other attendees. It was just awesome.
Was there a way to like click a button and share contact information?
Yeah.
So the reason why
you could whisper them. You could send them a DM with like your email address or whatever. And there you go. Like it was that simple.
Okay. The reason why I bring it up is because if you look at the piece, I took some images of the PAX Online digital booths, and they were essentially static web pages that had some assets that the publisher developed. Like you could click a button and watch a trailer, or you could click a button and look at screenshots. What you're talking about is real value add from an event organizer.
Absolutely. And Boston Fig, as far as I know, was a free event to attend. You just showed up. And you wandered around and you chatted with other attendees and you chatted with developers and you chatted with, you know, it was such a cool way to frame. And I could have stayed in there for another 3 hours talking with people because it felt so good to be a part of. It felt like a real community. It felt like a digital event should feel like an event, a con should feel, as opposed to something like the Game Developers of Color Expo, which is very centered around, you know, making sure that those panels are as frictionless and seamless as possible. They did an amazing job, especially with regards to their content curation last year and making it seamless for me to pop in and out of those talks, to ask questions, to flag for follow-up later, to download the VOD. They made it seamless. The only thing I wish GDOC would have had more of was me allowing me to interact with attendees on a real-time basis as opposed to just like sending messages back and forth or, you know, like that. Like more traditional online events. The way Boston Fig did it was mind-blowingly wonderful.
And I think that drives home the point that I hope that PAX Online and ReadPop take away from this. It's that you can't just rely on a Discord and some static web pages and call it a digital event. You actually have to invest just like you do every year with your live event. You can't just slap something together and call it a day.
Well, and I think that last year, everybody was really put off their game in general. And I think that we can allow a bit of grace for that. For the fact that we were all off our game, that we all struggled last year, corporations included, struggled as well to find their footing in an environment that was actively hostile to having physical in-person gatherings. It's hard to do when you are a physical live event company.
Sure, absolutely.
That's a huge pivot to make. And they did not have the core competency. They have a core competency to stream on Twitch because, you know, in the
they
biggest...
They do that for PAX live events.
Yeah, they do
some
that.
Of the panel halls.
Exactly. The bigger panel halls have that direct integration into Twitch streaming. But beyond that, creating a cohesive digital event is not as simple as some people think it is. Yeah.
The one thing I will point out in the piece before we wrap here is I implore ReedPop to be more transparent about its panels. Because one thing that I found out in researching this is that you as an exhibitor can pay money to guarantee yourself and your game, your organization, whatever, a panel slot. And none of those are made transparent or labeled as sponsored panels. GDC has sponsored panels. And you know, like, hey, somebody paid for this panel. That doesn't mean the panel's not good.
No, it just means that you are denoting where that transparency needs to be around sponsorships and about transactions.
The other thing is, like, the ReedPop staff could actually take pride in its panel curation and say, all right, this is the difference. Hey, we like these exhibitors. We love them. The panels are going to be good, but they paid for those panels. These are the panels that we put together that we think are going to be, that we selected from all the submissions so that you know that these are the ones that we think are going to be of most interest. I think that would be valuable for them, but I think for attendees, you owe your attendees that transparency.
I agree. Yes, absolutely. I had an inkling that that might have been the case because why would just regular panel submissions be up against, you know, when Outer Worlds was held their big panel at PAX in 2019, I believe. And I went and I think it was in 2019 at PAX West. Why would that be up against some smaller panels like ours talking about parenting and games?
Yeah, and you don't even have to. If you don't like the term sponsored panel, call it an exhibitor panel.
That's reasonable.
Yeah.
But also, sponsored isn't bad.
No, it's not.
It's not inherently
bad. It helps pay the bills, man. But you need to let people know that there's a difference between, and there is a difference between walking into a group of community members, journalists, professionals in the space,
putting
a panel together that's of interest versus someone who paid to get in there.
Absolutely.
And that's not, again, this isn't about shaming exhibitors who pay for panels. Like, it's a good part of the marketing and PR strategy.
Absolutely.
But you gotta be upfront about it. I'm sorry, you absolutely must be upfront about it. And if you're not, you're just creating a friction point. Because people don't know what they're getting. And some people might not want to attend those panels, or some people might just want to attend exhibitor panels. But be clear. Like, you owe people that much, because if people are coming paying to go to PAX, they have a right to that information, in my opinion.
Okay. And in my opinion, we wrapped up the podcast.
We sure did.
This has been episode 77. Thank you for listening to the Virtual Economy Podcast. You can follow us on Twitter at @VirtualEconCast. I am at Amanda Farrow.
And I am at Footerish, FUTTERISH.
If you enjoyed what you heard today, and I hope you did, minus my brain fog, you can subscribe to our RSS feed at virtualeconcast.com. You can also listen to us on all major podcast platforms, including Spotify, iHeartRadio, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, Pocket Casts. There's one more in there.
Pocket Sand.
Oh man, I hate Pocket Sand, especially when my brain's all fogs. We would absolutely love it if you would subscribe and, if possible, on your platform of choice, review the show. We love hearing about what you think.
Yes. And if you do want to let us know what you think, you can DM us with questions at Virtual EconCast. You can send us an email at podcast@fsquared.biz. You can join our Discord. You can just hit us up on Twitter if you would like an invite to the Discord. We'd love to have you. And if you have some secret information that you don't want to send via DM,
super secret,
that you don't want to send via email or send via DM, we both have Signal. We'd be glad to give you our Signal numbers. Just hit us up in DM or hit up the Virtual EconCast account and we can talk to you there. As a reminder, we are writing weekly on the virtualeconcast.com website. This week I published that story about PAX Online and about event costs. So you can check that out on the website. Last week, Amanda wrote about Animal Crossing. I wrote about
Discord.
Discord's potential acquisition and what it would mean for different large companies to acquire Discord.
Absolutely. And I am currently working on a piece about CD Projekt Group and what is going on with their restructuring nonsense.
Yeah.
And putting that into a little bit more context, going a little bit more in depth than what we were able to in the podcast. That's the nice thing about doing this writing is that we give you the overview of what's going on and then we go deeper into the stories.
Also allows us to keep the podcast just a little bit shorter.
Just a bit. I mean, like, we're still over an hour, but it's not 2 hours. Yeah. So, you know.
An hour and 15 minutes. And with that, we will be back next week. Remember to wash your hands, stay hydrated, and be good to one another.
We'll see you soon.